Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Here we are. Another program for the New Books Network. And I'm Mel Rosenberg, the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the NBN. And I'm here with a wonderful guest author, Julie Carpenter. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
And you are celebrating a wonderful new book on one of my heroes, not only mine, the whole world's. Tell us briefly about your new book.
Okay, so I've got it here. I'll bring it up there. So it's called Harry and the High Wire. And as you say, it is inspired by the world famous escape artist and magician, Harry Houdini. And more specifically, it's inspired by a moment in his childhood when he was 7, and he went to see the traveling circus and was inspired, sort of thrilled by seeing the high wire act. And then he goes home and he tries to emulate the high wire act himself, and it's whether he can do that. And it's really, I think my story is also this sort of time where he glimpses what he might become. He gets the performing bug and glimpses who he could be, really. And the thing about it, which I know you know, Mel, is that it fully folds out to 4 meters wide, or 12 feet, I think that is, however you do your measurements. Should I try and show it here?
Of course.
I don't think I'm going to be able to fold out the whole thing because, as I say, it's quite long.
We don't want to fold out the whole thing. We want people to buy this beautiful, wonderful book.
So yeah, so here it is. And the point of folding out is because you can follow a tightrope running all the way through it. And it's the tightrope or the tightrope equivalent. So it is a clothesline at one point, which then goes into a branch of a tree. And yeah, and then all the different places where he's practicing the tightrope. And a high wire gets thinner, towards the end of the book. And then, because of this concertina format, the end of the story is, I'm just trying to show you here, that's the end of the story. And then you have a picture of the real Harry Houdini. And so we have the whole back of the book, and I've done a sort of biography of the real Harry Houdini, and you can follow a timeline going all the way through. Maybe if I just put this down for a second, you can actually maybe see it slightly better. There's a timeline. And then I focus on three of his stunts, three top tricks, and little hints about how he did them. And I was a little bit torn about the hints on how he did them because, you know, Harry Houdini never gave away his secrets. And I tend to think there's nothing more intriguing about not knowing how something is done. So they're just little hints. So that's the book in a nutshell. I could obviously say a lot more. But
we shall. Yeah. And a minute about the publisher and the wonderful illustrator.
Yes, so the publisher is Green Bean Books. So Michael Leventhal, who publishes both Green Hill Books, which are military history books, and Green Bean Books, which are children's books. And Laura Catalan is the wonderful illustrator. I've never actually met her. She's Spanish. So I've seen her on Zoom, and we've obviously spoken a lot about the book, but always on Zoom. So hopefully one of these days I will meet her. But I think, you know, I love what she's done with the book. And even, I mean, I'm just going to open here the front and back cover. That's a complete picture. And you have some children sitting on the wire there, folding out the book just to show that it folds out, which I really like too. And there are so many little touches that she's done, which I really liked. I mean, one thing, because I was actually asked to do some...
Julie, whose idea was it to have this high wire running throughout the book? And have it folded out.
Yeah, this goes back to the wonderful Michael Leventhal from Green Bean Books. So he basically, so I mean, if I go into the story of how I started doing stuff for him, shall I? Or
we're going to go back to your childhood first.
Oh,
then okay. we'll connect okay. back.
Well,
with
yeah,
Michael.
So we had the concept for it, and then I was sort of writing around the concept for the book, and I did a lot of reading into Houdini. To sort of get a narrative, because obviously I didn't want it to be just about tightrope walking. It's certainly not a manual about how to tightrope walk. It's more about the influences on Houdini. And I think when I started looking into Houdini, you can't fail to notice how he is so dedicated, how he's got this amazing drive and determination. So that sort of informed the book as well. That's really the drive about how, you know, I wanted to try and do two things with the book. And the first thing was obviously to give a taste of the real Houdini, get sort of the essence of Houdini into it. And I try and mirror a few things which happened to his career, in his career, because he wasn't an overnight success.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. And he did almost give up just at the point when he was about to get his big break. So I have a little sort of place in here where Harry in my story is about to give up, but then doesn't, because he thinks about what he could become in the future, and it sort of spurs him on. So the other thing about Houdini is that I think he desperately wanted to do amazing, wonderful things. So that's like the first line in my book about, you know, how he was an ordinary boy who longed to do extraordinary things. But also I wanted it to be, you could appreciate the story just as a child who is, sort of realizing what they want to do and their potential and how they go about achieving it and not giving up. And hopefully, you know, hopefully to have it as an inspiring tale. But yes, we had, Mike and I had some brainstorming sessions right at the beginning. So we had the concept of the fold outs. And actually Houdini wasn't the only name that we were thinking about, because it all came down to, the type of project that I was going to try and do for him, and mm-hmm. then it would probably be biography, as opposed to I think we one of the things that you mentioned to me actually before we came on air is that the books that Michael publishes, they are books for everyone, but they have some Jewish content, and I am not Jewish, so it made more sense for me to do something for him which was more like a biography, as opposed to say a book on Passover or something like that, or something which you need to have the Jewish experience for. So that would fit things better. But yes, I don't know, I'm just rambling on.
No, I ramble away. So we'll come back to this. And just in one sentence, Julie, Houdini's name was not Houdini. When he was seven, his name was Eric Weiss.
Yeah.
And you call him throughout Harry, you know, the young Harry. Is this a marketing decision? Is it, what kind of, if the book was about the adult Houdini, but it's about a boy.
Yeah.
So you got ahead of yourself here, a sentence on this.
So I think really because he is known to everybody as Harry Houdini. So I think we just made that choice really that we would call him Harry all the way through. Yeah, we could have called him Eric, But yeah, we just went with Harry. Yeah.
Okay, that's fair enough. And
I think in the back, I tried to explain a lot about the real Harry Houdini and talk there about how, you know, his real name was Eric Weiss and go through his sort of history about how he was from a big Jewish family. He was, I think, fourth of seven children and give a lot of detail. I mean, I think there's actually more written on the back than there is on the front, funnily enough. But yes, I tried to explain it all there.
And very cleverly, you've taken a slice of life from his early youth, because I haven't seen that many picture books on Houdini. So I guess people haven't had this idea of going back to when he was a young child. So
yes, I was initially a bit skeptical as to whether this would work with Houdini, because exactly that, this is something that he's not known for. And so when we were thinking about this as a concept, I was Googling other people as well and seeing if there was something that fitted it better. Then of course you realize, no, it's perfect because he's not known for this. So actually, you know, I could tell that story, and it's a great opportunity. And as well, because, you know, I don't know whether to call him Harry or Eric now, because he was
call him Harry.
At the time, then, you know, it appeals to kids because he's the age that, you know, this is in the 4 to 8 year sort of age category. Although I think, you know, who doesn't love a picture book, really? I think it could appeal to all ages, but particularly kids, you know, they like reading about other kids, I think. So I came around to thinking, yeah, it's perfect that it's Houdini.
Yeah, no, I think you did very well. So let's go back to Julie Houdini.
Okay.
People usually write about things that are close to them. Did you walk tightropes as a young British girl?
No, I wouldn't say tightropes, no. So funnily enough, when I wrote this, so we came up with the idea just before lockdown. And then lockdown happened. And I live very near a huge heath in London. And I went out on the heath a lot with my kids. And we did a lot. I mean, there was particularly some branches that we would every time. I mean, it was the only place that we could go. You know, you couldn't really go that many places. And so we did a lot of balancing on branches, which is partly why there is a branch in here. Oh, I opened it at exactly the right page that Harry is balancing on. Although, I mean, I do have a little bit of a circus connection in that my grandfather, who I never met, did become a ringmaster. So he was a ringmaster, yes. And my mother has told me like loads of stories about him, how he used to have this pet chimpanzee who used to steal her dolls. And he apparently used to sleep on a bed of nails. I don't know whether that is just legend. But yes, yeah, so there is that association, I suppose. Yeah.
Interesting. And what were you like as a young child?
So I think I was quite studious, actually. And I did read a lot. I read a lot and I drew and painted a lot. And I think I went through different phases of loving different authors. And I think at different times in your childhood, you sort of migrate from one author to another, went through a real Roald Dahl phase. I actually loved Roald Dahl's Revolting Rhymes. I don't know whether you know those. I think sort of slightly less famous than the BFG and Matilda, but what he basically did is he took fairy tales and put a spin on them, usually a bit of a macabre spin, you know, and it was all in rhymes. And I took it upon myself to do all the fairy tales that he didn't do. And I did reams of them, which I would read to my parents. And then I had a phase of Terry Pratchett with all his Discworld novels. So I tried to, you know, write books like that and, you know, sort of create my own worlds. So I did a lot of that. But yes, I guess I was quite studious.
You ended up going to Oxford, so you must have been a good student.
Yeah, I guess that's the studious side, isn't it? Yes. Yes, I mean, I would say though at school, I was quite torn between sciences and arts. I think I found in a way kind of art subjects took more out of me, but were more rewarding in the end. But I did have a real difficulty in choosing between them. But I think I always knew that I wanted to go and study English literature. So that's, yeah, that's what I ended up doing. So yeah, I was lucky enough to go to Oxford and to study, yeah, English literature and language, actually. That was the course, English language and literature. So you had to study Old English too, which I think people confuse with Middle English and Chaucer, but Old English, Anglo-Saxon, is a whole different language. It declines like Latin. And so we were reading things like Beowulf in the original Anglo-Saxon, which I don't think was my favorite part of my degree, if I'm honest. But yes, I spent 3 years doing that. And I worked on a student paper when I was there as well. But I think when I finished that, when I got my degree, I slightly panicked and was thinking, what next? Because I'd been concentrating on my degree. And yeah, I think because then I worked for a student paper, I ended up contacting all the sort of national papers in London, sending in lots of examples of my work and my CV, and most of them, well, some of them replied saying, have you heard of our graduate training scheme? It's all full for this year, but you could apply for next year. So then I randomly started ringing up papers and saying, have you got the stuff that I sent in? And one of them said,
I knew there was this connection. You're a very determined female version of Harry Houdini.
You
don't give up, do you?
I don't know. Okay, to that extent, I think that was driven by fear. I think I needed to support myself, and I think that I was worried about it.
So did Houdini.
Yes, yes. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he had you know, a very deprived background, certainly through a particular period.
Julie Houdini phoned all the newspapers.
Yeah, and one of them, I think someone said, oh no, we haven't received it. Do you want to send it again? And I think I said, well, I could just come. Why don't I just come tomorrow? So I came, I turned out with my CV and some examples, and then I never really left that newspaper. so they put me on their graduate training scheme. And I did that for 2 years, which was, you basically learn on the job. You spend 3 months in different departments, news and sport and features. And then at the end of that, they gave me, they offered me a job on what we call the social diary and what most people think of as being the gossip column, which I have to say was not somewhere where I thought.
From Beowulf and Old English.
Yeah.
And Oxford to the gossip column.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What did your family say?
Oh, my family was just very encouraging, actually. You know, they just left me to it. They just wanted me to do what I wanted to do, really. And yeah, I think I remember them saying that, you know, we will help and support you through school, but then you're on your own.
Then you're walking the tightrope yourself.
Yeah, I like these illusions that you're coming up with.
So you started in gossip, and who did you gossip with, Julie? You gossiped with famous people.
Oh yeah, so it was all about, so the column that I was on, and it went through various incarnations. There was sort of political media one and a showbiz one, and it did change at the time that I was there. But it was mainly about going to openings, events, and first nights, and yes, meeting all these famous people and talking to them, which obviously I look back on now and it feels very surreal, this world that I entered. But it was amazing. And, you know, I was in my sort of early 20s when I started, and I stayed there for a good part of my 20s because it was such an opportunity. And it was amazing the amount of people who I met and spoke to, and just the events that I attended as well was amazing. Yeah. These PC premieres. I mean, it was a real diverse amount of things that you went
invented.
To.
You invented. You interviewed. You interviewed stars from television, British prime ministers. My goodness.
But it was more meeting people at parties in the diary. So it was less formal than that. Sure. And some of them, for things like premieres, you were there with your little dictaphone. But otherwise, it was just chats. And then we'd run off to the loo and write everything down, which was like having already obviously said who we were. So it was a bit like that. It's funny, though, because a lot of people who I met, my kids, it doesn't resonate with my kids at all. But I think the person who they are most excited about the fact that I met was Buzz Aldrin, so second man on the moon. And for them, they think, oh, wow, an astronaut. That for them is the one that they always sort of come back to.
Maybe Buzz should be your second picture book.
Well, there we go. Yeah. It's a good idea.
I don't know if Michael will publish it. He might publish it with his history title.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Not military.
Not military.
I'll speak to him on your behalf.
Yeah, I do.
Wonderful. So you worked as a journalist for the best, no, I won't say the best, let's say the most famous newspapers in England.
Well, yeah, I mean, I stayed at the same. So I sort of got to the end of my 20s, I was going to leave that paper. Yes, that national paper, daily paper. But they then offered me a job as a feature writer and theatre critic. So which was something that I at the time I really wanted to get more into, something slightly meatier, more writing. And I covered a lot of theatre first nights when I was on the Gossip Column. And I really loved doing that. And you'd think we'd all be fighting over going to those events, but actually they were quite late nights because you'd go to the theatre first night and then they'd have the party afterwards. So you didn't leave until, you know, quite late. And so I managed to seem to go to most of those. And I wanted some sort of continuity there. So they were looking for another theatre critic at the time. So myself and a colleague, we split most of the West End openings as well as both being feature writers. So, yeah, I ended up doing that for a good many years after that. And
I'm a fan of the West End in London, as you know.
Yeah.
What are your favorites of the old ones that I love?
Well, do you know what's funny is I took my children, I have a son and daughter, and I took them to Matilda the other day, which was for my daughter's birthday. And they still had a quote from my old review from when it opened, however many years ago, outside the door. So that was really lovely to go back and see that. So yeah, I think I'd given it a 5 stars. You know, it's fantastic. It's, you know, a fantastic production. So my kids like that as well. I remember going to the first night of War Horse. And I actually sat next to Michael Mapogo in the audience whilst I was reviewing it. So there's lots of events like that. We used to get some really good names going to the West End, as you still do now. So I feel I've seen some amazing productions. Actually, yes, feel very lucky to do that. And it was always, you know, a little bit stressful. They always put you on the end of the aisle when you're a critic so that you can rush out to file your review, because you don't get long. If you're writing for the next day's paper, they have deadlines for when you've obviously got to file. So you do not have long at all to write your review. So that used to stress me out a bit, because you just didn't, you know, sometimes I feel like it would have been really nice to have slept on it and, you know, be able to slightly tweak my review the next morning.
Julie, were you thrust into theatre or the job opened?
Well, what actually happened was when I finished when I wanted to move off the Gossip Column, I actually asked whether I could do a column, which was sort of backstage theatre. So more like sort of theatre gossip. And they didn't want that. But they said to me, but actually, we are looking for another critic. So would you like to do that instead? And I felt, yeah, very fortunate to be asked to do that. And I hadn't done any theatre criticism. I did, you know, I guess it all feeds again sort of into the sort of English degree, the things that you did a lot of sort of criticism then in my degree. But I'd seen so many productions when I was on the Gossip Column as well. So I was sort of up to date with theatre.
So that helped you ready yourself.
Yeah.
for this new direction. And now take us from the West End to Green Bean Books and how you became a children's author.
So when I had my son, I didn't go back to my sort of full-time staff job on the paper. I always intended to, but then, you know what it's like, you have a child and your whole world changes. So I decided not to. And I have to say that my work were great and they did offer me part-time, but I knew that I wanted to try for another child as well. So I didn't go back. And then when my daughter was about 2, so I went on to have my daughter after that, was when Michael Leventhal established Green Bean Books. So Michael used to be a journalist with me on the same paper back in the early days. And so he was on the gossip column with me. That's what he did.
Oh, I wish I had known that when I interviewed him.
Yeah. We went to a few days together.
Interesting. Okay.
And I stayed longer, you know, I stayed in journalism, obviously, a lot longer than he did. And he went into the whole world of publishing. And we just kept in contact as friends for that time. And when he established Green Bean Books, he asked me whether I would like to come on board on a freelance basis to help edit the children's books that he was doing. And it came at a great time for me because I was then looking to do some more work and just to get back into some work. And of course, having two young kids, I'd been totally re-immersed in the wonderful world of children's literature and revisiting lots of old stories. And it's sort of almost like you go back to your childhood a little bit, don't you? Rereading all those stories and then reading all the new books that were coming out and getting a feel for what my kids really liked as well in children's literature. So that was great. I started editing some of those books for him. And then Michael did his own book, which I'm sure you spoke to him about, The Chocolate King. And I helped him on the editing side with that as well. And Michael then kept saying to me afterwards, you know, you've got to do your book. When are you going to write your own book? And it's something I really wanted to do. And that comes back to then thinking about what might work for Michael, what might work for Green Bean Books. And we came sort of thinking, again, something biographical would suit me and would suit him. So that's really how it came about.
So it wasn't a work for hire, but it came about as almost a work for hire.
Yes. So there was no guarantee that it was going to be published. I remember when we were having lunch in a cafe, and so at the end of his Chocolate King book, he had a couple of pages that folded out. And I remember him saying to me, I really want to do a fully fold out book. And, you know, it's typical Michael. He always wants to do something really exciting, really innovative, something he's never done before. And I love the idea. And he said, well, you know, maybe this is your project. And as I say, we did, he had mentioned Houdini beforehand as well as one of the, an idea of one of the people who I might do sort of biographies or some sort of biographical story on. So there were a few other names in the mix in the beginning, but that's how it came about. And he just said, you know, why don't you have a go and, you know, see what you think. Yes, as I say, no guarantee that it would be published. And it was really when PJ Library became interested in it that I think really clinched its production. And that was after a while because, as I say, then this was just before COVID, and then COVID happened. And, you know, everyone's experience of COVID was different. Mine was very busy. And looking after my two kids, and there were lots of homeschooling. And I was still doing some editing for Michael as well. And occasionally we'd be speaking on the phone and he'd say, that book, are you gonna write that book? And I was like, yes, I am. But I did, again, so as well as being busy, I wanted to read a lot of biographies. I wanted the story to kind of take shape in my head before actually putting pen to paper. And then Michael did. I sent him the first draft. Michael sent it straight off to PJ, which I hadn't quite expected. But yes, he did that more or less straight away. And there were certain things, I think they were interested, but there were certain things they wanted changing. So it did go through a few sort of drafts, as I discovered these things do. And at one point as well, things were very much dictated by how you could pull it out, the book. So at one point, I think I thought we had double the amount of pages that we had, but then we realized, no, that's the back of the book, and that was going to be something completely different. That's how it came about. And there were certain things, like, for instance, I don't think I've mentioned Banjo yet, have I? Banjo the chicken? Oh, So that was one of the things. When I was reading books on Houdini, I was thrilled to discover that Houdini, when he was younger, had this pet bantam chicken called Banjo, and named by his mum, and it would come when he whistled and starred in his early magic tricks. So I love this idea. And I made Banjo a she. I wasn't sure whether Banjo was a he or a she, but at the time Houdini had five brothers, so I wanted Banjo to be a she. And I only mention her in the narrative on at the very end. But within the art notes that I was asked to write, I asked if we could have Banjo in every picture so that there could be a sort of story within a story. And I know how much my children love having something different to spot on every page in a picture book. And I think that Laura has just done that really, really nicely. And so there's literally every spread, you can see Banjo. Banjo's peeking in at the window in the first one. I'm not sure how easy it is to see this, but yeah, in every page, there's Banjo, which I love. Actually, there's a page towards the end where it's a sort of a scene where Harry is dreaming. Well, it's so if I just read it, it's talking about when he started to become good. So in time though, Harry started to become good, and not just good, but really good. Yet still he practiced so much that the soles of his feet ached, and all he dreamt about were wires stretched across the whole wide world while he tiptoed along them. And so it's that scene. And Laura has done Banjo. I just assumed that Banjo would be there with Harry in one of these, but she's done Banjo as a constellation, which I really liked. So getting back to
how... what's that, Julie? The book is just out now, right?
Yes, yeah, so it was published over here last month, and it's being published in the US at the end of this month.
And it's being published especially for PJ?
So PJ have already sent it out. They sent it out last month in their seven-year-old category to, thousands of children.
In the folding edition?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm going to talk about your magic for a moment. I think that I've interviewed almost 200 authors. And when it comes to writing a picture book with a traditional publisher, it's always magical. There's always some kind of magic involved because the odds are one in several thousand. And I want to think, because your book is so well written and the idea is so great and so brave, that your break was not as a children's author. Your break was coming in at the national level as a journalist.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Because as soon as you turn your spotlight, your writing spotlight, to picture books, well, it's just, it's a minor alteration for you. You know, it's like shortening the cuffs. And then, you have all your writing skills. Your trajectory coming to picture books is incredible. But I will tell you that just like the odds of becoming a national journalist are one in a zillion, the odds of getting a publishing deal are also one in a zillion. And PJ Library turns down 99.9% of its books too. So you are very privileged. And maybe you don't even know that. Maybe you didn't even hear of PJ Library.
I did. As soon as I started working with Michael, I absolutely did. Yeah. When I heard, how that PJ were definitely taking it, I was really, really thrilled, actually. The fact that it is several thousands of copies that they took, and it's been so lovely as well, just seeing some reviews pop up and people talk about them reading the book with their children. And also I've had such a great response from, say the parents of my children's friends, and they've been sending me photos of their children having folded the book out, you know, on their living room floors, going into their hallways or their landings. I remember one of my friends sent me
You can measure the size of your living room with your book.
Exactly. And I'm not sure it'd fit in my living room. And so one of my friend's daughters was literally walking along the tightrope herself, having folded it all out, or someone putting their toys along it. And it's been really, really wonderful seeing the reaction. And it's been a really amazing experience. And I would absolutely love to do more. 100% I would. But no, I do feel very lucky for having the book published. And it's funny because there are obviously, you use your writing skills in sort of different ways. And even though something like the gossip column feels very different, and for me as well, that feels like quite a long time in the past. But for them, you had to write in quite a succinct fashion because they're quite short stories. And again, that's what I would see a sort of parallel with the you know, children's book, particularly, you know, picture book writing, that you do, every word counts and you have to be really careful. You can't go on, because I would like to go on and on and on writing.
We all would. But here's the other thing. You're not the first journalist that I've interviewed. And journalists have a sixth sense for honing in on the story and finding the story and telling the story. So I'm kind of not surprised. If you had this, and I was a microbiologist. If you have a love for writing, then it's possible to learn the differences in writing a picture book. And then all you have to do is be really, really, really good, as you are. So now the question is, you have this book out. It's a special book. It's a toy. And it's getting traction. I didn't mean that to be a pun, but it is. So your book is getting traction. And now what are you going to do?
Well, Michael has got me working on about 5 different projects for him on the kind of editing side. So he's keeping me busy with other projects. I am also writing my own things, but I'm not sure whether they're right for Michael. I love doing rhyming things. I've always loved it. Going back to what I was saying.
I love Michael, but here's the thing. Now that your book is out and it's doing well and getting reviews and people love it and children love it, Michael's going to be angry with me for saying this, but you don't have to publish all your books with Green Bean, you know. There are other publishers. You can look for a literary agent in Britain or the States. And I think you should really. And
there are definite next steps.
And even though as a Jewish guy, I think it's terrific, you know, writing these stories about Jewish people. But you don't have to do that either, you know.
No, absolutely. No, and I appreciate that is that bit of advice. I think the road can be quite hard, I think, to go and find another publisher. But yes, I would love that challenge, and I would love to be writing.
The road is hard. You're saying that? The Julie Carpenter who phoned the newspapers and just showed up? Come on.
No, I absolutely want to do that. And I am, you know, writing more things, and I'd love to.
It's always hard, and you're always competing with hundreds of other authors. Yeah. And nothing is easy.
No, you've completely brought it back to the book, haven't you? Because that's the whole message that I wanted to tap into.
And you're telling me, oh, I'd like to write more, but it's hard. Come on.
It's so funny because I keep telling my kids, I mean, this is what I see with my kids as well. If something doesn't happen really easily, they think it's not worth pursuing. And I keep telling them, no, if you have something you want, you should. You've got to work at it.
And you have to show your kids that you're an acrobat, just like Eric Weiss. What is the thing about Harry Houdini that you wonder about most? Because I have my own wonderment. What's your wonderment? I don't know if that's a word in English. It is now. What is your wonderment about Harry Houdini?
I've been writing a few articles, going back to, you know, my journalism, because, obviously to publicize the book and to tie in, because also this year is the 150th anniversary of Houdini's birth. So I've been writing a few stories about, you know, Houdini's, what Houdini's greatest escape is. And you could say it's from, you know, the poverty and deprivation of his childhood. And also, why are we still so fascinated by Houdini? You know, don't we have now magicians who are quite as, you know, amazing, spectacular as he was? I'm not sure that we did, but I think the drive, what drove Houdini, I think is really fascinating. And in many ways, I mean, he has talked about it, but you could argue there are so many different things that drove Houdini. And I think he did want to be the best. And I think the trouble is he became the best and carried on, you know, pushing himself to these really extreme limits, both physically and mentally. So he's already got to the top of the tree, but he carries on doing it. I think that is really interesting about Houdini. I mean, honestly, there are so many things that are so interesting about Houdini, but I think that is one of them. And I think people still to this day do wonder why he put himself under those sort of conditions on a daily basis. I mean, he really was risking his life for entertainment, you know, every night. And things could have gone wrong, and things did go wrong for a lot of other magicians in that era, in the whole sort of vaudeville era. You know, they died. Other magicians died doing similar tricks.
Well, he died also after getting punched in the stomach or abdomen. There's question as to whether that was a direct cause. But
yeah, I think that's very contentious as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Shall I tell you my wonderment?
Yeah.
You haven't asked me anything, Julie.
Yes, please do tell me, Mel.
Okay. You're an interviewer. Come on. What Houdini did is he fooled people.
Yeah.
Right? He fooled people. But when he encountered people fooling people to bring back the dead, this drove him crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It was like... This is what I wonder most about, like, I would like to sit down and have a talk with him about why he became such a Michiganer, we the Jews say, a crazy man, disproving seances and all of the people who pretended to be talking to the dead. So
yeah, it's really interesting.
Because what they were doing is they were using the same shtick that he used in some of his acts, right?
Yeah, I think there's a clear difference, actually. I think that he was always very, very open about the fact that he was a magician and he did use trickery. And I feel that what he thought these fraudulent mediums were doing were deceiving people, and deceiving people who were also in a state of, you know, real grief. They were trying to track down people who had died, you know, particularly at the time he was doing it in the First World War. And I think he hated that sort of manipulation of people, because he could say, look, what they're doing is what I do in my shows. And it's a show. It's an act. I'm a magician. And I think he hated the fact that they were just deceiving people. And by the way, I think he was desperate to try and have something proved that was true. I think he was desperate to have some sort of real evidence that there was an afterlife. Hence why, you know, he had this pact with his wife that if one of them died before the other, they would try and send a message through.
You see what an interesting character?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
He resented people toying with this because it plagued him also, whether there is an afterlife.
Yeah. Yeah.
So interesting. Such an interesting guy. Very self-promoting on the one hand.
Massively.
And loving of humanity on the other hand.
Yeah. But I think as well, he was really ahead of his time when it comes to self-promotion. I mean, he was incredible, really. The things he would do to get himself known. I mean, all his jail escapes, they were all, you know, geared towards getting front page news. Where, I mean, every town that he performed in his acts, he would go and get locked up.
Do you have a jail here? Is there a jail in this town?
Exactly. And then he'd invite the local press. He would easily break out from their most secure jails, having been handcuffed, triple locked, and, you know, manacled to a pillar or something, and stripped naked, which they always stripped him naked so that he couldn't sort of have some sort of lockpick somewhere. And yeah, always break out to their bewilderment. And then, you know, it caused front page news, sold out shows. I mean, he was constantly self-promoting in a time when, you know, people weren't doing it to anywhere near the degree that he was doing.
Yeah, we say today, really, you have to be your own brand. Well, 100 years ago, he was his own brand.
Yeah. And actually, that's also quite difficult when you're writing some sort of biography of Houdini. He was also very aware that he was creating his own legend, I think. So there are lots of stories that he embellished. And it's sometimes difficult to know which ones were real and which ones were the Houdini slight sort of tampering with the truth. But that, again, just makes him all the more fascinating, really.
Fascinating, and a wonderful book, and a magical book about a magical human being. And Julie Carpenter, I'm expecting more magic from you in the future.
Well, I'd love to be in touch, Mel, yeah.
I'm going to haunt you. because I think that you have now embarked on the start of a illustrious career as a children's book author. That's my feeling.
Keep it being as possible, me.
My feeling and prediction. Usually I ask authors to give advice to up-and-coming authors, but you've done everything in such a unique and different direction. Yes, of course, if you're a national journalist, that's a great way to pave the way to become a children's book author. But do you have any other advice for the people who are, you know, doing the regular thing, writing manuscripts, sending them to agents? Any advice for someone who didn't go that route?
Well, like you say, I think that I'm in the position where I'm garnering advice from other people. But I think in a way, the only piece of advice that I could really give is to actually just keep writing and keep doing things, because I am a real procrastinator myself. And that's why I think working for a daily newspaper worked really well for me, because I had deadlines every single day when I had to file my feature. So in some ways, you need to impose those deadlines on yourself in order to actually, you have to lock yourself up. When we talk about Houdini again, you lock yourself in a room and actually, you know, put pen to paper. So yeah, I guess that is what I would say, but yes, I would love advice as well from more people. And actually, some of your podcasts, Mel, are great for that, I have to say.
You should listen to more of your podcasts. Thank you very much. The authors and the wonderful authors of this genre, which is a magical genre of picture books. So hold up your book again.
Oh, yeah. Here it is.
Harry and the High Wire, the slice of life, magical fold-out book. about Harry Houdini, Eric Weiss, written by Julie Carpenter, illustrated by the wonderful, I can't remember her name, Laura Catalan. And published by Michael Leventhal, also a magical figure in his own right.
Absolutely. And,
so Julie, I'd like to have you on the show again when your next book comes out.
That'll be fantastic. I look forward to it.
So thank you so much. I'm Mel Rosenberg, and I am, before I forget, the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network, and I've been having fun talking with Julie Carpenter, a national reporter, turned children's editor, turned magical author in her own right, of a wonderful book on one of my favorite magical heroes, Harry Houdini. Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Mel. I appreciate it.
We'll be in touch.
Bye.